In Romans chapter 13, we're told to pay to all what is owed them.
Taxes to whom taxes are due. Customs to whom customs are due. Fear to whom fear is due. Honor to whom honor is due. Honor is due the king. Even if the king is not honorable, he is to be honored. It is his due.
Renewing Your Mind is next. Well, that can be a hard pill to swallow, can it? But keep in mind, Paul wrote his letter to the Roman church, a church that had been oppressed, even crushed, by the burden of Roman taxation. Yet Paul told them to pay what was due and to honor those in authority. I think many of us have a lot to learn in this area about submission and humility. Let's continue Dr. R.C. Sproul's sermon series from the Book of Romans.
We've seen in the beginning of chapter 13, Paul's critical teaching of the role of civil government, which is instituted by God. And here we are told that the rulers, the secular rulers of this world, are God's ministers. And in our last time together, I tried to draw applications of this text to questions of civil obedience, as well as questions of capital punishment and theories of just warfare, inasmuch as this is the classical locus of the text by which God gives to the civil magistrate the power of the sword. And having looked at that section, we are warned that the civil magistrate does not bear that sword in vain, and he is not to be an enemy to good works but to evil, and that we ought to have a certain healthy fear of civil authority, and again, not simply out of fear of punishment, but the apostle now forges ahead here. Therefore, you should be subject not only because of wrath, not because you simply are afraid of the terror of the law enforcement agencies of your nation, but also for conscience's sake. Let me just pause on that. What Paul is saying is that our responsibility to bend over backwards, to be submissive to the civil magistrates, even when those magistrates are oppressive, even if we disagree radically with them, nevertheless, we render obedience to those magistrates as a matter of conscience, because our consciences are to be held captive by the Word of God. And if God Himself authorizes these rulers and have placed them over us, again, unless they command us to do something God forbids or forbid us from doing something God commands, then we are to render this obedience not out of a matter of fearing their power, but out of conscience's sake, as a matter of principle. When's the last time you heard anybody tell you that you have to live by principle, that this is at the heart of Christian ethics and of Christian life, that we are to live by conscience as people of principle, not out of expediency, not simply doing willy-nilly whatever our hearts desire, but we are to be in the main submissive people, submissive ultimately to the law of God and to every other authority that God places over us. Now, Paul now turns his attention to the question of the payment of taxes. This is one of my favorite issues. For because of this, that is because of conscience, you also pay taxes. For they, that is these magistrates, are God's ministers attending continually to this very thing. Render therefore to all their due, taxes to whom taxes are due, customs to whom customs, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. You know, I really admire the Apostle Paul for his faithfulness to Christ and his courage to tell the people of God to do their duty, even when that duty was something they absolutely despised. Keep in mind that the Roman government, in their taxation and tribute policies, was indeed an oppressive government. And the people who were receiving this admonition from the Apostle Paul were people who had been oppressed and crushed by the burden of Roman taxation. Paul says, pay your taxes. They might be unfair, they might be oppressive, they may be unjust, but in the first instance, remember that God gives to the civil magistrate the right to levy taxes, because the civil magistrate has to have his reign and rule financed. And since governments usually don't produce anything, most of their revenue, if not all, is dependent upon not the voluntary contributions of the constituent members of their nations, but by the imposition of taxes, and which taxation is also exercised and enforced by that sword that we heard about a while ago. But in any case, every government in every society throughout history has been involved in some form of the levying of taxes. It is the government's right to levy taxes, and it is our responsibility to pay those taxes. Now, let me add something here. Any government to whom God gives the right to levy taxes also receives from God the responsibility to levy taxes that are just, that are righteous. I don't know if there's ever been a civil government in the history of the world that has maintained a righteous system of taxation for any period of time. If you go into the pages of the Old Testament, you will see one of the things about which God is passionate, in which he speaks to his people through the prophets, is the oppression that was brought upon the poor by the rich. But the rich that are referred to, that are selling the poor for a pair of shoes, for example, as Amos complains, were not the merchants of Israel, but they were the rulers of the nation. It was the kings and the princes who were using their power to extort burdensome payments from the poor. But in any case, we see throughout the pages of the Old Testament unjust, unrighteous, and oppressive burdens of taxation given to the people. And we are also witnesses of the biblical testimony of the Old Testament that God hates that, whether it's by a Jewish king, a Babylonian king, a Roman emperor, or the Congress of the United States of America. Doesn't matter what civil magistrate. Every magistrate is called to levy taxes in a just and righteous manner. And so we ought to be involved with the paying of our taxes as a matter of conscience, and yet at the same time being scrupulous in supporting righteousness and justice in whatever system we're engaged in. Now, the idea of justice is deeply embedded in this text, where Paul tells us, render therefore to all their due. Taxes to whom taxes are due, customs to whom customs, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. There's a little word in this portion of the text that I have to be honest with you, jumps right off the page to me when I read it. And yet I am aware that unless people are rooted and grounded in the history of Western philosophy, would probably read over this text 1,000 times and never have that word jump out at them the way it jumps out at me. You have a beauty contest, and you bill this contest as an opportunity for contestants to vie for the crown of Miss America or Miss Sanford or Miss whatever, and that the qualities by which the winner will be judged will principally be physical beauty. And then the judges come to the contest and they see that an ugly duckling has entered the contest. And they feel sorry for her. And so they decide to vote for her to be Miss Sanford or Miss Florida. My question, is that just? Well, if we use a merit system, we would say that the decision that this person is voted the winner of the contest had nothing to do with merit, nothing to do with good behavior. The woman was not crowned Miss Sanford because she deserved it through some kind of moral uprightness. And so the question of justice may be irrelevant unless we use the definition of justice that was offered to the Western world by Aristotle, where he said the principle of justice is this, in its most simple explanation. It is giving to people what is their due. Now, if you advertise a contest where the prize will be awarded on the basis of beauty, who is due the victory? The one who is most beautiful. That person is due the reward, even though there's no merit or virtue in being beautiful. Nevertheless, the terms of the contest were defined in terms of an aesthetic criterion, and whoever meets that criterion in its greatest dimension is now due the prize. You're following what I'm saying here? If that's correct, then righteousness and justice have an awful lot to do with the question of due-ness. Let me give an illustration of that, which may trouble some of you. I hope you'll just sit loose with it and think about it. But one of the great ethical debates that we face in Christian ethics is the question about the sanctity of truth. And the question is this: are we always, in every circumstance, obligated to give the unvarnished truth? And there are many Christian ethicists who answer that question in the affirmative and say, yes, that righteousness demands that you always tell the truth with no exception. Then you go to the biblical examples of Rahab, who lied to protect Joshua and his people, and who makes the roll call of the saints for her valorous action in the New Testament. Even better, you look at the midwives of Egypt who were instructed by the edict of Pharaoh to call the guards as soon as they knew that a Hebrew woman was about to give birth so that the edict to destroy the firstborn males would be carried out. But the midwives disobeyed. And to protect these newborn babies, lied to the soldiers, saying that the midwives, you know, that the women were quick on the stool and all of that business. And so they practiced deceit to the authorities and saved the lives of the babies. And we were told in the text, and because of that, God blessed them. And so many students of ethics say there is a place for the righteous lie. There is a place for the just telling of a lie. When we talk about truth, the biblical principle would be this: we should always tell the truth where righteousness and justice require it. But the principle here that is used that defines justice and righteousness is this principle of that which is due, that which is owed, that which is obligatory. And what Paul is saying here is we are obliged to pay our taxes. We must give the state what is due the state. And justice and righteousness require that we submit to their taxes. That's what he's saying here. When he says, render to all their due. Taxes to whom taxes are due. Customs to whom customs are due. Fear to whom fear is due. Honor to whom honor is due. Honor is due the king. Even if the king is not honorable, he is to be honored. It is his due. We are to honor our father and mother because honor is due our parents. They may not deserve it. They may not have earned it. They have not merited it. That's why we can't reduce Christian justice and righteousness to the simple formula of merit and demerit. They may not earn it at all, but by God's decree, it is their due. And I am to give honor to whom honor is due. We're so casual, so cavalier, so foreign is the concept of honor to our culture. Yet the biblical culture of ethics is built on honor. Giving honor where honor is due. To your boss, to your parents, to the civil magistrates, and yes, to your pastor. It's one of the benefits. Well, let's go on. Verse 8. Owe no one anything except to love one another, for he who loves another has fulfilled the law. Now, what follows here is an exposition of the way in which love fulfills the law, and I'll treat that, God willing, next week. But let me look at the first part of the sentence, because this is a passage that has been, I'm afraid, so widely misused in the church and in our days. Many people come to verse 8, owe no man anything but to love him, and see that as a biblical mandate against the incurring of debt. And that we are told that it is unchristian to borrow money, to build churches, to build our homes, to buy an automobile, and so on, based upon this text. Owe no man anything but to love him. And that would seem to indicate that we ought never to incur any kind of indebtedness. Now, if you look at the whole scope of sacred scriptures, you will see that there are vast provisions for taking on debt, and also that there are guidelines to protect people who are in debt in Scripture. On the first instance, there are strong prohibitions against oppressive usury. What is usury? Usury is an exploitively high interest rate that bleeds people dry. If our culture were exposed to the law of Israel, the level of interest rates that are routinely charged by credit card companies would clearly be seen as usurious and would come under the judgment of God. They're way too high, and they exploit people and their weaknesses. And so you have that principle in the Scripture with respect to lending and rates of interest. You also have strong considerations for the poor who give as collateral for their indebtedness personal garments. We read the mandate that if a person puts up as his collateral his garment, which he needs to keep warm at night, that the creditor can keep that garment during the day, but is required by biblical law to give it back to the man for the coldness of the evening. But if you look at all of those different scenarios, you will see that they are all based upon a culture ordained by God that allowed borrowing and lending. As long as the lending and borrowing was not exploitive and oppressive. Now, is that all dismissed now when Paul says, "Owe no man anything but to love him"? Now, there may have been commentators in the history of the church who have taken that to be the meaning of verse 8, that verse 8 prohibits incurring debt of any kind. Like I said, there may have been commentators in church history who've interpreted this text in that manner. I'm just not aware of them. I don't know of any who do that. Any commentator I've ever looked at and consulted on this portion of the text says that the basic point that the apostle is making is that we operate only under one perpetual debt or obligation, and that is to love our brothers. And what he's talking about here about not owing anything except love is has this application towards borrowing and lending. The point of the text is this, in the structure in which it was written. If you borrow something and you borrow money and you owe it, there's no sin in that. The sin comes when? When you don't pay it. When you don't fulfill your obligation. I wish you could spend a day in the accounting room at Ligonier Ministries, see how many people order products, receive their invoices, and never pay for it. It's epidemic. Now, there is where people are taking advantage of loans and then not fulfilling their obligation. It doesn't just happen at our ministry. It happens every ministry in the world, every ministry in America. It happens in every department store. And of all people, Christians, when they incur debt, as a matter of principle and as a matter of conscience, must move heaven and earth to honor their obligations. If you owe somebody something, dear friends, pay what you owe. Pay your bills. Pay them on time. You enter into a contract, fulfill the terms of the contract. That's not difficult. That's basic integrity as far as our duty to live in righteousness. And again, this is connected to what the apostle had just said when he says, render taxes to whom taxes are due, customs to whom customs are due, fear to whom fear is due, honor to whom honor is due, payment to whom payment is due. It's fundamental. And it now is wrapped, as we will see, God willing, next week, in the overarching principle of love. If I borrow from you, if I borrow your rake, and you live next door to me, and I borrow your rake and I don't return it, I'm not loving you. I'm using you. And all of these practical applications of righteousness and justice that Paul is explaining here are rooted and grounded in, again, that overarching responsibility we have to love our neighbor as ourselves. These are nothing more, nothing less than practical applications of the golden rule. But God willing, we will explore that in greater detail next week.
From being subject to authority to loving our neighbor, we covered a broad range of directives today, but there is a common thread: treating others as we wish to be treated. Romans is often referred to as Paul's magnum opus. The doctrines of sin and salvation are so clearly expressed in this letter. And I think you'll find Dr. Sproul's sermon series very helpful as you study these doctrines. We'd be happy to send you all 59 sermons on a single USB drive. Just contact us today with your donation of any amount, and we will send it to you. This is an online offer, as our offices are closed on Sunday. The web address is renewingyourmind.org. And in advance, let me thank you for your generous donation. We'll be wrapping up this series in a few weeks, so if you've been thinking about requesting these sermons, let me recommend that you contact us soon. Again, our web address is renewingyourmind.org. Next Sunday, Dr. Sproul returns to Romans 13. In verse 14, we're faced with a command that reaches to our very core. Make no provision for the flesh to gratify its desires. We'll hear that challenge next Sunday here on Renewing Your Mind.